the first days are the hardest days. Don't you worry anymore. 'Cause when life looks like easy street, there is danger at your door. Think this through with me. Let me know your mind.
You're listening to one of the Grateful Dead's most well-known and well-loved songs, Uncle John's Band. It's recorded for the album Working Man's Dead in 1970. But you could say well-loved about many more of their songs, especially if you do so from the perspective of the Deadheads who followed them across the country, in some cases around the world, just to swing to the music. The band would stay together another 25 years after that, 30 years in all, producing a mountain of music. In 1994, the Grateful Dead was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and just a year before, the leader of the band, Jerry Garcia, died. Now, an exhibition at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland is underway. It opened today, I think. It's called Grateful Dead, The Long, Strange Trip. For more information on that, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have some links there for you. Coming up later, we're going to hear from David Ganz, the musician and author of what is considered the definitive interview book with the Grateful Dead. Joining us now is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame curatorial director, Howard Kramer. Welcome to the show, Howard.
Thank you very much, Ann. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're not with us because you're the director. You're with us because you actually curated this exhibit.
I put that one together, yeah.
Question for our listeners, calling all deadheads. The Grateful Dead's freewheeling concerts epitomized the communal theme that ran through the Grateful Dead's culture. For our listeners, do you have a Grateful Dead concert story to tell? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. It would be a lot of more fun if we hear from people that have memories of seeing the Grateful Dead in concert.
I don't think that's going to be too difficult in your neck of the woods. That whole Central Ohio is a stronghold for the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right. This is a busy rock week in Cleveland, though.
You could say that. I think that's the understatement of the century as far as we're concerned. Yeah, we've had a lot going on here. We opened up our brand new library and archives. We've had a series of concerts celebrating the upcoming induction ceremony. Of course, the Grateful Dead exhibit, our gala opening was last night. We have the free concert for the city of Cleveland tonight. The induction ceremony itself is Saturday. You know what? A lot of us are going to be sleeping late on Sunday.
The Grateful Dead were inducted in 1994. Yeah. What inspired the exhibit 18 years later?
Well, they were always a subject that we wanted to touch on. And it took, I think, a lot of time to pass for them to kind of say, all right, we're willing to let someone tell the story in this manner. We first approached them about participating in an exhibit in 1996. And of course, that was about a year after Jerry had passed. And it was still, feelings were fresh. And when I finally got back around to asking them again about 2 years ago, what about it now? The answer finally came back, you know what, we're ready for this. You know, this is okay to do. And the best thing about it is there were enough resources available to make an exhibit to illustrate the Grateful Dead story.
Right. I read somewhere that I think it was you that told one reporter that the mere fact that an archive related to one specific and significant band exists is a major achievement, and one based largely on the fact that so much material remained.
Yep, that sounds like my quote. Yes, I did say that.
So why do they have so much material? I mean, why the trove?
There's a lot of fortuitous accidents here. And in the case of the Grateful Dead Archive, is something at the Special Collections of McHenry Library at University of California, Santa Cruz. And it came about because when the Dead stopped working as a band in 95 after Jerry Garcia died, they continued as a business entity until about 2005 when they shut down shop. They were basically had an office, and this office was full of stuff, and a lot of it was collected by a woman named Eileen Law, who essentially ran their office. And the choice was either put it in a dumpster and have it go to landfill, or maybe this is valuable and we should consider giving it to someplace.
Right.
And the proposal was made to UC Santa Cruz, and they decided that, yes, they were willing to take on this project, and that's how the Grateful Dead Archive came about. But it was between the yes and no of, yes, let's do something with this, and no, it's going to hit the landfill.
My guest is Howard Kramer, curator at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They have a new exhibit there. It is called
Grateful Dead.
The Grateful Dead, The Long Strange Trip. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I know.
Yeah, it's Grateful Dead. Something about the Grateful Dead. Sure. Let's hear from Tom and Heath. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. My wife and I, what you would call, were Working Dead, and we planned our vacations around the Grateful Dead concert. One of my favorite songs, Little Red Rooster. One of my favorite concerts. Actually, there are more than one, but one was in Buffalo, New York, with Steve Miller. And then the concert that wasn't was in Cleveland when we had the blizzard. Now, that was a riot because we were in a hotel with all the deadheads. You know, of course, we're there, too. And they're trying to fire up their hibachis in the hotel rooms to cook, you know, make their meals and sell their wares. And the state fire marshal was there about three times, I guess, or, you know, the fire marshal for that area. Finally, he just told him, buddy, you know, if you keep lighting your hibachis in the rooms, you know, we're going to have to ask you to leave. But there was nowhere to go. And there were Volkswagen minibuses spinning all over the road. It was, you know, it was just great. And the people at the concert were the best people in the world. That's all I have to say. You know, it was just one big family.
Well, thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
Take care, Tom. Yeah, you know, I was Grateful Dead drummer Mickey Hart tried to describe the emotion that the band brought to its concerts and its music and how they really gave it all they got and their connection to the Grateful Dead followers. He said, I don't know if an exhibit can hold that kind of emotion. Did you feel challenged by that notion, Howard Kramer?
Absolutely. There's a huge responsibility with doing an exhibit on a band like the Grateful Dead in that in as much as the fans know more than I ever will. And I could read every book and listen to every recording, and there's something about the immersion in the culture that gives you a knowledge that is invaluable. My goal with this is, to Mickey's point, was to create something that told a story about the elements of the Grateful Dead, not the individual achievements over a period of time, and then really fill that in with the relationships that existed, the primary relationship being the band with the audience, the music and the audience.
And tell us, describe the exhibit. How did you, what does it look like? I've seen read descriptions saying it's non-linear.
Yes. It's, again, it's,
mean it's not chronological?
Exactly. It's okay. Not a chronological, you know, this happened, because the Grateful Dead have participated in a lot of important events in the history of rock and roll, but just being there doesn't mean that you were the important part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's broken down into elements of who the band is, biographies of the band members, so things about their songs and their records. The group is a touring entity, as their relationship with their fans, taping culture. There's a section called Fellow Travelers, which talks about people who were around the group who influenced them, people like Ken Kesey and Neil Cassidy, as well as people who were on their crew. I mean, they're the only band whose audience can name the crew members as well as the band members, which is a pretty remarkable thing to consider. And then there's a section about gear, the equipment that they use. And one of the sections that I'm really, really happy with is art. The Grateful Dead probably have more visuals associated with them than any other group. And there's a lot of original artwork. The actual original painting, the first source piece that was used for an album cover or a poster.
What about the tie-dye T-shirts?
Right, there's not a single tie-dye T-shirt in the exhibit.
You're kidding me.
Well, this isn't about always about the things that sprouted up around the band.
Mm-hmm.
This relates directly to them. I mean, it's easy to do a cartoonish and shorthand thing about the Grateful Dead. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, pot-smoking hippies in minivans. But that's not what it was about. And I want to make sure I went well past that and, you know, the usual imagery of bears, roses, skeletons. There had to be something more to the story and more substantive. And we got some really great feedback yesterday from the visitors here about the exhibit, so quite pleased with how it's been accepted.
A lot of deadheads roaming around.
There were quite a few deadheads. In fact, I had like three of the biggest deadheads in the world here yesterday. Except not David Gans. David will be here soon. But a number of the biggest deadheads in the world, and they gave me their thumbs up. So I slept well last night knowing that.
Well, I imagine a lot of them will be wearing their tie-dye T-shirts.
They are more than welcome to. We'll probably even sell some in the store.
What about sound?
In terms of audio presentation,
yeah.
There's an ambient sound where every lineup of the Grateful Dead is represented, because I think that was very key to understand that it's not Jerry Garcia in big letters and the Grateful Dead in the small letters. There's a lot of people who made contributions, whether it's Donna Jean Godshaw or Tom Constanton or Vince Welnick. I mean, they were all part of this story. And then there's also a couple listening stations where you can hear tracks from particular shows, or actually one of Neil Cassidy performing with the Grateful Dead. There's a big video element, too, on the sixth floor.
And members of the band, were they in last night?
Mickey Hart was here. He and his band performed, and last night, very late, took Mickey on a tour of the exhibit. And he says, you know, it's kind of strange walking through a museum and seeing your own stuff, but it's best to be there when you're alive and can enjoy it, which I thought was a very, very good way of looking at things.
They lasted for so long, 30 years. And like you said, so much of what they were about was visual. You spent 2 years collecting.
Yeah, just about 2 years working on this one.
And then when you put an exhibit like this together, you don't do it alone. Did you talk with them, or?
Well, I worked very closely with David Lemieux, who is the I don't want to say asset manager. He's the guy responsible for the catalog and all the records that come out for the Grateful Dead nowadays. David oversees those projects. I also work with a gentleman named Nick Merriweather, who's the Grateful Dead archivist at UC Santa Cruz. Two of the major Grateful Dead heads were here last night, mm-hmm. and both of them possess an extraordinary knowledge of the band and the history. So they were kind of like my true north on this whole thing. I did speak to Mickey and Bob and Bill at various points, and they were very helpful, but they also kind of had a hands-off way of doing it. You know, all those guys have visited the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum and respected the work that we do here, and left it to me and my colleagues in the exhibitions and curatorial department to put this together. You know, I work with a very talented group of people. John Sloboda, my colleague who designed the exhibit, you know, he knows what he's doing. And then our exhibitions team who installed it, these folks are, you know, A-list professionals. So when you have a great group of people working on it, you can help. You can make a really good thing.
Did you follow the Dead?
Not particularly. I mean, I did see them twice, and I enjoyed the group, and I had a couple records, but they weren't my favorite group of all time. And I think that kind of helped in the fact that I didn't come to it with exceptional reverence.
Right. Well, I want to thank you, Howard Kramer, for taking time out of this incredibly busy week to talk to us today.
Well, Ann, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's an absolute honor and a privilege, and I hope our friends in Central Ohio come on up 71 and get on the bus, as it were.
Ah, there you go. Sounds good. Howard Kramer, he's curator at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he curated Grateful Dead, The Long, Strange Trip. It just opened. There's information on our website if you want to learn more about it at WOSU.org/AllSides. We'll be back with the aforementioned David Gans right after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and WOSU Public Media presents Chefs in the City 2012, featuring celebrity chef Hubert Keller along with an elite group of Central Ohio culinary greats. The TV show is coming up in May, and a culinary-themed auction begins online April 15th. Included will be Chef Jay Cottrell of M at Miranova, who is showcased all this week on our Facebook page. Be sure to like Chefs in the City on Facebook.
Support for 89.7 comes from COSI, presenting Race, an exhibit the whole family can explore together, open now through May 6th. Dr. Cornel West will be at COSI on April 18th in a lecture titled Race, The Untold Truth. Tickets and information at COSI.org.
46 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high near 60 degrees. Clear skies tonight, a low of 39, sunny for Friday and a high of 65 degrees. An increase in clouds Friday night, but not as cold, a low of just 47. Also expect a chance of showers and thunderstorms looking ahead to Saturday, a high of 69. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Speed, trouble ahead.
That's the Grateful Dead's Casey Jones, recorded in 1970 on the album Working Man's Dead, widely known as one of their most popular songs. You can learn more about that and more at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which today unveils its new exhibit, Grateful Dead, The Long Strange Trip. For more information on that, go to our webpage at wosu.org/allsides. Joining us now to continue our conversation about the Dead and their culture is musician and author David Gans. He wrote what is considered the definitive interview book with the band The Grateful Dead. David Gans is a noted expert on the Dead with several books to his credit and was the producer of a few of their albums. And he hosts a radio show devoted to The Grateful Dead. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for talking about The Grateful Dead, my subject matter.
Yes, well, it's always fun. As soon as I saw they were having an exhibit, I jumped on it. Yeah, you know, I can tell you that right now. For one thing, I love music shows, but their music special, very different. What do you make of the idea of an exhibit for The Grateful Dead?
Well, it's a natural for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum. And The Grateful Dead, it's an amazing story from any angle. I'm a musician first, and my journalistic approach to The Grateful Dead has always been to put the music first, but I've also been a participant in that culture for 40 years. And it's an amazing thing. The Grateful Dead changed. They were really like several different bands over the course of their life, because Jerry Garcia was the constant through it all. But as I heard Howard say at the end of his interview there, it wasn't Jerry Garcia in large type and the rest of the guys in small type. It was a collaborative form, and the changes of personnel changed the music. The decline and fall of Pigpen, who was their original co-frontman, and the rise of Bob Weir as a performing and composing talent. Factors like that, and the fact that they acquired a huge and devoted audience over time. You know, they began in the psychedelic 60s in the same neighborhood scene with the Jefferson Airplane and Big Brother and the Holding Company, but they took a very different path from those artists. Both the Airplane and Janis Joplin, you know, sold millions of records and became sort of conventional pop stars in a certain way. And the Grateful Dead never sold very many records. They made their living and they built their audience by getting out there and playing for real, in real time, every time, doing it different. And what they did encouraged people to engage them repeatedly, you know.
Well, they wanted to see what they would do next. Let's listen to the song Turn On Your Love Light. Ron McKernan, nicknamed Pigpen, was the original lead singer of The Grateful Dead until his death in 1973. Let's listen to his signature Turn On Your Love Light.
Without a warning, you broke my heart. Taking a baby, turn it up. You left my understanding in the dark.
I can hear the Grateful Dead there, but the sound of his voice is so different.
Yeah, he was whatever opinion or image people may have of the Grateful Dead, it probably centers on a fairly soulful and kind of homely lead singing voice of Jerry Garcia. Because after Pigpen's decline, you know, he didn't really perform after the Europe 72 tour. And the vast majority of people who are fans of the Grateful Dead never saw Pigpen play live. But if you go back, and one of the glories of the Grateful Dead universe is that almost every show they ever played was recorded, and there's a huge archive. You can go back and listen to shows going back to the very beginning of the band, and that's another reason why their community is so huge and why an archive exhibit is such a valid thing for them. So a guy like me, I didn't see the Dead until 72. I saw Pigpen exactly once, and I was 19 years old and very high and didn't really understand what was going on. So the only time I ever got to see him was that one time. But I've got since, you know, all the archive is there, I go back and listen to Pigpen, and it's a very different band from the one that sort of that Jerry Garcia was the leader of. So when you hear Pigpen, you're hearing a really deep blues voice, fronting this band that was heavily into psychedelic exploration. So it was a really unique musical hybrid that changed into a different, unique, and equally valid musical hybrid after Pigpen departed.
Now, Jerry Garcia was with the band when Pigpen was with the band.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes.
The core four, as they call it. Well, Jerry Garcia, Bob Weir, the rhythm guitar player, mm-hmm. Phil Lesh, the bass player, Bill Kreutzmann, the drummer, and Pigpen, the keyboard player and lead singer and harmonica player. That was the original quintet. They added a second drummer, Mickey Hart, in 1967. And he stayed with the band until 1971 and then departed for several years and then came back. They added another keyboardist at the end of 1968, a gentleman named Tom Constantin, who came from the extremely sophisticated modern music world from which Phil Lesh also came to the Dead. And so the music changed every time they made a personnel change, with the common thread being the original central guitar figures and Phil and Bill, the rhythm section. But it's kind of hard to explain it. I'm actually in the process of writing a book about it at this moment.
About the science of their music?
About the musical development. The music is kind of the hardest thing to get a grip on. And since mm-hmm. I came to the Grateful Dead as a musician first. And when I went to them as a journalist and started interviewing them, I was doing so from a musician's point of view. And the reason that I was able to form good relations with them over the years was that they knew that I understood what they were doing a little better than most of the journalists they dealt with. But it's a complicated story in the sense that every one of those musicians, there were no sidemen in that band. There were no minor players in that band. If you were in the band, you were in the soup in a major way, and you were affecting the music. And again, it's kind of hard to explain here. I'm trying to give this to you in short sound bites, and it's hard to describe it because it was so immersive, so involving, and so dependent on the character and personalities of all of the players. You know, it wasn't possible to be a minor player in that band.
Well, let's listen to the band.
Okay.
I guess it's the best way to talk about it is to listen to it. The Golden Road to Unlimited Devotion. One Grateful Dead song that seems to be signature to their music in the 1960s is that song, released in March 1967 on their debut album titled The Grateful Dead. Let's listen to a bit of that. Yeah, I really get a folk music note there.
Well, yeah.
Kind of that, you know, hootenanny.
Well, that's where they came from. Mm-hmm. The funny thing about that song is they hardly ever played it live. That song was written after they had completed what they thought was their first album and given it to the record company. The label said, in that way that record labels do, "We don't hear a single." And they went and they wrote that song and recorded it and put it on the record, and it was the opening track, but it wasn't a song that they really felt, and they didn't play it live more than half a dozen times, I think. So in a way, it is, you do hear folk music because they came from folk and bluegrass and jug band music and blues, but that particular song is sort of hardly representative.
Mm-hmm.
That song is an anomaly in many ways, but The Dead arose from a folk music scene on the San Francisco Peninsula that also gave us Paul Kantner of the Jefferson Airplane, Jorma Kalkinen of the Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna, and lots and lots of great musicians. David Crosby was part of that group, although I don't think he ever lived he crossed paths with Kantner and David Freiberg, later of Jefferson Starship, during their college days also. So they were folk musicians and bluegrass musicians who came together in the 60s and started taking LSD to as many people did in that time, and started forging a music that was much more ambitious than that. And they played for a couple of years. They played really intense, psychedelic kind of Baroque folk music, of which their album Anthem of the Sun is a serious creative peak. And then in 1969, they started returning to their roots and brought out the acoustic guitars and started moving in a direction of a more country rock kind of sound. As I said, the Grateful Dead were several different bands over the course of their history. They wound up, in the last 15 years of their existence or so, they were more of a sort of arena rock band, playing a narrower musical range, but much more powerfully.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is David Gans, musician, radio producer, and author, and considered an expert on the Grateful Dead. You'll be going to the exhibit, Howard Kramer from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame said tomorrow?
No, actually, I'm coming in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
I'm in California.
Okay.
I will be visiting in a couple of weeks to help with a sort of press event, and then I'll come back. During my regular travels, I'm planning to visit the exhibit and maybe do a radio show from there in July.
You know, it seems like we've heard as much about the Deadheads and their culture as we have about the Grateful Dead, at least from the outside.
Yeah.
And I know people who were genuinely depressed when Jerry Garcia died in 1995 and the band folded. Do the members of the band feel that same connection to their followers?
Yes. Very much so. The whole thing was about the real-time experience, and there was, especially because the whole thing started during that time in the 60s when everybody in the hate was taking acid. You know, that as controversial as LSD may be, it was a very powerful social lubricant and tool for changing the way you looked at things. It made the music sort of melt together in interesting ways, and it also allowed the audience to participate more. There really was a sense, and I know this as a musician, although I don't play high on acid. I tried that once. I kept forgetting what song I was supposed to play.
I don't know how they did it.
Well, they
didn't, though, necessarily.
Well, say again?
They didn't necessarily do drugs when they played.
Well, in the early days,
right.
They did.
Yeah.
That was the experience. The acid tests that they did with Ken Kesey,
right,
and his Merry Pranksters, that was all about everybody getting high on acid and creating an event together. See, that's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
At the acid test, it wasn't a band and an audience. At the acid test, everybody was part of the show. Everybody paid $1 to get in, including all the participants. And you dressed up and participated. It was kind of an interactive theater thing before that term existed. And from that crucible, the band recognized that they were getting energy from the audience, and they paid attention to what the audience was giving back to them. And that was always part of their music, was listening to the audience as well. And it's not in the sense of information like, you know, play a C sharp.
Mm-hmm.
It was more the feel and the vibe of the audience. And again, I know this as a performer. You sense what's going on, and you look at the faces, and you see the people dancing, and that gives you information about where to take the music. It was truly different every time the Dead played in the early days, and they were paying attention to what they were getting back from the audience. And they also always gave a full range of emotions in their music. Their music could get very, very quiet, could get extremely loud and raucous. There could have two different time signatures going on at the same time because they had two drummers. And Jerry, in particular, could sing these really, really bleak, dark, quiet, ruminative songs. There was a song called Death Don't Have No Mercy that you'll find on Live Dead that's a really sort of stark blues tune. And they recognized that you can't really appreciate the light without the darkness. And so they would do these beautiful, huge, joyous dancing, you know, 20-minute excursions of Turn On Your Love Light with Pigpen, but then it would be followed by this really quiet, you know, sweet, dark thing, because they gave their audience the full range, and they got back from their audience wisdom about how to perform.
I have lots of emails. If you want to email us, you can do so to allsides@wosu.org. You can also call us, 614-292-8513. From Veronica on Facebook, the program I have finally been waiting for. Favorite song, Box of Rain. And we actually have that, and so we're going to play that for you, Veronica, as soon as we get it popped in. Here we go. Another good example, I suppose, of how they could harmonize.
Yes, that was Phil Lesh, the bass player, who didn't write very many songs and didn't sing lead on very many songs. That is on the album American Beauty, which is really one of their finest records, and written by Robert Hunter, the lyricist, who mostly collaborated with Jerry Garcia, but wrote with all of them. That's another example of the uniqueness of the Dead. They had a lyricist in residence who was a member of their family, but not a performing partner. Robert Hunter, who wrote all of the, I think pretty much everything we've heard so far. No, he didn't write Love Light, obviously. That was Bobby Blue Bland. But Hunter was writing songs with Bob Weir and Jerry Garcia and Phil Lesh. And then Bob Weir brought in another lyricist, a very famous gentleman in cyberspace named John Perry Barlow, who, if you Google him, you'll find an entire other world of stuff that he's done. But he wrote that's another just amazing thing about the Dead, is that they had two truly brilliant poets contributing lyrics to their songs as well.
From Rachel on Facebook, she writes, I can't wait to take my parents to see this exhibit. They introduced me to the Dead at a very young age, and even though I never saw them in concert, they were a big part of my childhood music, along with the Beatles and the Stones. This will be a great way to thank my parents for my excellent taste in music and the story of me singing All I Ever Wanted during a kindergarten show. And Tell Day is a favorite of my parents. Sorry we don't have that one on tap.
I think that's a new Riders of the Purple Sage.
Is it? Okay. I didn't see it. One of the things I remember growing up through the 70s and 80s were the tape exchange parties.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there would actually be very valuable tapes. You mentioned that the song that very rarely did they play in concert, that became valuable.
Well, valuable in a non-monetary
sense.
Yeah, because the Dead they were recording themselves so that they could improve their performances. They would actually sit in the hotel room after a show and listen to the recording and critique each other's performances, and they would also pull new ideas from those tapes and develop them into songs and stuff like that. But the audience also started taping their shows because every show was different. Everybody of a certain mentality wanted to preserve it and hear every different performance. And so a culture arose of people who would sneak their tape recorders into shows and record them and then trade them. And that created a weird and wonderful culture that was marked by both incredible generosity and just absolutely ridiculous materialism. Because if some people had a tape that other people wanted, they would be kind of really annoying about wanting something in return for a copy of it. But the vast majority of tapers that I know, I've known over the years, are people who just wanted to share the magic. So they'd sneak their tape recorder in, and then they would make copies for anybody who wanted it. Now, of course, in the internet era, everything is out there online. If you go to archive.org and you click on the audio archive, you will find a separate tab in the audio archive for Grateful Dead. And there are literally thousands of recordings available online, and you can listen to almost, I would say probably 80 to 90% of the concerts the Dead ever played are available for you to listen to on demand at archive.org. It's absurdly bounteous.
My guest is David Ganz. He's an expert on the Grateful Dead. There is an exhibit opening. It'll be actually today. It'll be at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame through December 2012. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. On the next Fresh Air, Fernando Trueba, the director of the Oscar-nominated animated musical Chico and Rita. Also, Jason DeParle, who covers poverty for the New York Times, examines how the 1996 welfare reform law has affected the poor during the recession and how some politicians now want to apply those welfare reforms to Medicaid and food stamps. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Here's your opportunity to win the new iPad and support our station. Our spring membership drive begins soon, and by becoming a sustaining member early, you'll be automatically entered to win the new iPad. Visit WOSU.org now, make your sustaining gift, and get registered. No pledge is necessary, but your support will continue to pay for the programs you enjoy. Entries are only accepted at WOSU.org. Thanks for supporting 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, providing a disciplined approach to help individuals and small businesses grow and maintain their wealth. TheMontgomerySolution.com.
50 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high right around 60. Clear skies tonight, a low of 39. Sunshine for Friday, and a high of 65. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Standing on the moon, I got no cobweb on my shoe. Standing on the moon, I'm feeling so alone and blue. I see the Gulf of Mexico as tiny as a tear. The coast of California must be somewhere over here.
That's Standing on the Moon by the Grateful Dead and released on their Built to Last album in 1989. You can learn more about that and more at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which today unveils its new exhibit, Grateful Dead, The Long Strange Trip. For more information, go to our webpage at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now to continue our conversation about the Dead and their culture is musician and author David Gans. He wrote is considered the definitive interview book with the band The Grateful Dead. If you have a question or comment for David Gans, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org.
And if you don't mind, I'd like to give the title of
yes,
that book.
Yes, I actually was just sent a message to my producer saying, what's the title?
It's called Conversations with the Dead, and it's available as an ebook from Amazon and the usual places. And it is just interview transcripts. You know, I had collected stuff and written an earlier book called Playing in the Band, but this one is just Q&A interviews directly talking with the musicians and various people involved, including the late, great Owsley Stanley, who was their sound designer and patron for many years, and also the guy who made all that great acid in the early days that helped launch the music.
You've commented on the business of the Grateful Dead. Were they good businessmen? I mean, I think I was reading an article that you wrote that referenced something like $50 million a year was getting raked in one way or another.
Yeah, that was probably just something I said in passing because that's never really been the most
okay.
important or interesting part of it. But they did never had any money when they were younger. I mean, they never cared about that stuff. They wanted to play music, and they wanted to play music on their own terms. And they somehow managed to scrape by. They spent several years in debt to their record company and all this other stuff. And then they kind of broke through. They managed to survive without selling lots of records. And then in the 80s, they kind of broke through and started reaching a larger audience and playing larger places and really making some serious money. And I could tell you from direct personal contact that some of the guys in the band had no idea why. I mean, they felt good about the music they were making, but they didn't understand why it suddenly sort of hit this critical mass and started attracting larger numbers of people. But by the last 5 years or so of their existence, the band was having trouble controlling the audience, the size of the audience, and the nature of the audience that was following them around, because the scene outside their shows had become this this sort of underground economy mm-hmm. as well. And people would come just to hang out in the parking lot and not even plan to go into the show. You know, it got complicated, and it got kind of heartbreaking toward the end because things were kind of out of control, which was an outgrowth of the Grateful Dead sort of refusal to direct their audience and try and control things, and just the nature of the hysteria, the enthusiasm that surrounded them. It was a phenomenally attractive culture to be part of if you were into that sort of thing. A lot of people found the whole thing kind of creepy. I think you go around in the world and people will say just incredibly awful things about the Grateful Dead. And it's been my experience and my personal research over the years that a large number of people who think they hate the Grateful Dead, basically what they don't like is the stereotype of the deadhead. That stoned guy in the tie-dye, you know, extremely loud clothing, who talks in kind of hippy-dippy terms and stuff like that, and thinks they want to share your food or whatever. It's a stereotype, and it's kind of a stupid stereotype. And it doesn't really have much to do with the Dead. They weren't really hippies themselves, in a way, except in the very, very beginning. But around them sprang up this culture of people with this kind of this notion of sharing, you know, the trading tapes and just selling burritos in the parking lot to get to the next show and stuff like that. But the vast majority of deadheads that I know are people with real jobs. I know a huge number of deadhead academics. I know a guy right there in Columbus who's a scholar of international relations is a deadhead, and Senator Patrick Leahy is a deadhead. Vice President Al Gore was a deadhead. Walter Cronkite was something of a deadhead. I mean, you know, the stereotype of a Grateful Dead fan is just sort of just BS, really, in a way.
Like most stereotypes, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's generalizing from a small number of examples into an entire population, and it's equally unfair in this case as it is in almost every other case where you see it happen.
As I mentioned earlier, some of those parties that I went to where people were trading tapes and that sort of thing, or borrowing them, their recollection of the concerts was amazing.
Yeah.
How they could recall specific songs, even when the song went on for, hey, what was the longest song they ever played? Did anyone ever?
There are books where you can find that out. Off the top of my head, I remember a couple of things just from the discourse. And again, because I've been writing about this and programming a radio show for more than 25 years, I can tell you that I think the longest single song on record is a Dark Star from 1973, but I can't remember exactly where. And there was a 45-minute playing in the band in Seattle in 1974, and I sort of hate myself for knowing that, I have to tell you.
Well, I remember how I discovered it, but that's another story.
It matters to people. That's the mm-hmm. thing. It's really the music. When I go on tour, I carry with me a disc drive full of Grateful Dead music to listen to study for my radio show. You know, I'm picking the best of that music to play on the radio every week. And I listened to stuff kind of at random out of the archive, and I pulled a show from the spring of 1973 out that was like 4 hours long. There were 17 songs in the first set and 15 songs in the second set, some of which were extended, you know, 10, 15-minute songs. And the band stayed on stage literally for like 4 hours playing and making a really amazing music. And then 2 days later, they set up in another city and did the same thing. And people wanted to hear that because every performance really was different, and there was some, and not every single song, obviously.
Right.
A lot of the shorter songs sounded pretty much the same from one day to the next, but Jerry Garcia never played the same guitar solo twice, and there would be a different mood. Each song could be taken in a different way, depending on what mood the players were in. And somebody could play something more aggressively or more sweetly or more creatively, you know. So you never knew. Jerry Garcia could play a solo that would make you weep in the middle of a song that was or otherwise, you know, kind of unremarkable. So you never knew when the golden moment was going to come, and that made it incredibly compelling for people to want to hear every version of it.
Let's hear a song of theirs that is very memorable, and I don't know how often they riffed on this one, the song Truckin', released in 1970 on the album American Beauty. It's special for a few reasons, one being that in 1997 it was recognized as a national treasure by the United States Library of Congress. Let's listen to the song.
Most of the cats that you meet on the street speak of true love. Most of the time they're sitting and crying at home. One of these days they know they gotta get going. Out of the door and down to the street all alone.
Chugging like a doo-dah.
We only get 29 seconds of that, but how'd the band feel about the national treasure status?
I haven't talked to any of them about it. I think that they sort of eventually sort of resigned themselves to the sort of weirdness of being so beloved, you know, because they struggled for so long just to keep it together in the early years. When they got comfortable and rich, it changed a lot of things, and it actually introduced a new set of problems to them. But I think that it's hard not to feel humbled and appreciative of that kind of attention. You know, it means that your art is effective.
An email from Bobby asks, is it true that the band took its name from the anti-nuclear, The Dead Will Be Grateful?
No.
Not true. From Kimberly on Facebook, she writes, I was unable to attend any shows, but my only Dead story was seeing an old bus painted up hippie style in a parking lot out in Las Vegas years ago, just before a show. A couple cop cars were there, and a bunch of people were all lined up facing it with hands on the bus, spread eagle, getting pat downs from the cops. You know, I was always surprised when I would go to a show how few law enforcement officers were there.
Depended on where you were.
Okay.
Most places recognized that this was a fairly harmless crowd, but there were some places where the notion that they were going to be, it was easy pickings for the cops because they figured it was a very strong likelihood that somebody who was dressed like that probably had some pot in their pocket or maybe some mushrooms or something. Mm-hmm. And there were some venues that were noted for having, you know, really aggressive police presences. Out here on the West Coast, I was fortunate to live in Bill Graham's universe, where they had good relations with the local authorities and used basically members of our own community as security people. And everybody recognized that this was a peaceable gathering and that nobody was going to get hurt. You know, I felt more danger at a football game than I ever felt at a Grateful Dead concert, just from the sort of the toxins of choice and the aggressive nature of sports and stuff. It's very different. In Grateful Dead music, there are no winners and losers. Everybody wins, and it's a much more sweet and peaceful gathering. But in America in this century, having a Grateful Dead sticker on your car is probable cause in some venues, and the cops can pull you over, and the chances are they'll find them.
Gail in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Gail.
Oh, hello. I had a contrast. I've only seen it twice. Once was in 68, running for Pete Townsend, The Who, at Beth Memorial, which is a real kind of constricted venue. And then we had the privilege of seeing him in 72, 73 at the Ohio, Ohio Palace.
At the Ohio Theater?
Yeah, the Ohio Theater, okay. The very ornate, beautiful place.
Right.
On Halloween, right around Halloween. And they went on. And actually, what struck me was I really didn't pay attention to the band that much, except for the organist. I just remember the music and the people and how we just took over the whole place.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazing. Can you imagine that? And your guests won't understand this, but it's a very ornate theater with all these balconies and all this. And here are these guys just hanging out, coming on stage, acting like normal people. And the music starts. And then 3.5 hours later, the place is just still rip-roaring going.
Isn't that a wonderful feeling?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, that show you're talking about was released or a big chunk of it on CD. It's Dick's Picks Volume 2 from Halloween of 1971.
Oh, was it 71? Okay.
Yeah, if you could go to dead.net, yeah, you can actually buy a huge, like a 80 minutes worth of that show. And I remember that one and re-listened to it recently. That was a pretty fine performance. But yeah, you're right. They could go into any space and make it a comfortable. I was just rereading Dennis McNally's excellent biography of the Dead, The Long Strange Trip. And the way he referred to the stage as their living room. You know, that's where they lived. And they didn't treat it like a showbiz thing with a proscenium and footlights and a separation. They really, it was their living room, and they were there with all of their friends who were you in the audience.
And we had so much access, and there was so much freedom, and everybody obviously was very lit up, but the way we treated each other was like a family.
Of course, Gail, let's make note that it was pre-renovation of the Ohio Theater.
Yeah, but
so now they wouldn't let you all in.
There's no way. I can't even imagine. But, Gail, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. I want to grab a few more before we have to go. Corey in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Corey. We're running out of time, though, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, I was just wondering if your guests had any comments about the All Good Music Festival, which is going on this summer in Thornville, Ohio, where I believe three founding members of the Dead are going to be performing on different sets. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thanks, Corey.
That's a festival that's run. I haven't been to that particular one, but I've been to that site in Thornville. The Dead used to play there too. I can't remember. Suddenly, I can't remember the name of the venue that it was back then. But now it's called Legend Valley, and there's actually going to be another event there. The Dark Star Orchestra, which is the premier Grateful Dead tribute band, is hosting a festival on that same site over Labor Day weekend. The upshot of it, though, is that all of the surviving members of the band are still making really, really good music. And 17 years after Jerry Garcia died, they all have their own voices. And this, too, is testament to the power of each of those individuals as a musician, that they didn't collapse when they lost Jerry. They went on in their own directions. And the Mickey Hart Band is a brand new effort that is just fantastic. I really love their new album, Mysterium Tremendum. And Bill Kreutzmann is in a band called Seven Walkers. Bob Weir is going to be touring with Bruce Hornsby this year, doing some stuff. And we're running out of time, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, we are. But Hornsby used to open for the Dead.
Yeah, and he played with the Dead, actually. Mm-hmm. After in 1990 to early 92, he toured with the Dead to sort of help them get through the loss of Brent Midland and get Vince Welnick up to speed, because Bruce Hornsby was a Deadhead and played in a Dead cover band when he was a kid.
David Gantz, thanks so much. We're going to go out on a song, Feels Like a Stranger, but from the early 80s, released in 1981 on Dead Set. But I want to thank you first for joining us today. I could have gone on for a lot longer.
Yes, it's always fun to talk about my favorite subject, and thank you for allowing me to do so.
David Gantz, musician, radio producer, and author. His book, Conversations with the Dead, the Grateful Dead interview book, is considered authoritative. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1, Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from COSI, presenting Race, an exhibit the whole family can explore together, open now through May 6th. Dr. Cornel West will be at COSI on April 18th in a lecture titled Race, The Untold Truth. Tickets and information at COSI.org.